Ya, el año.
Just one little point, just to add something. We were talking about the machlokas in the Gemara. Did the Jewish people hear the Ten Commandments on the 6th of Sivan, or did they hear it on the 7th of Sivan? And again, two points to remember about that. Number one, everybody admits that the 40 days of Moshe and Har Sinai begins on the 7th. Because that's how you get 40 days to the 17th of Tammuz, when he comes down and breaks the Luchos. So the Machlokas just is, did he get the Ten Commandments on the 6th and didn't enter the cloud until the next day? Or did he get the Ten Commandments on the 7th and enter the cloud the same day? But everybody admits that the 40 days and the 40 nights, that begins from the 7th. That is one point. The other point I made a number of times is to remember that everybody admits that the holiday of Shavuos is on the 6th, even if we didn't get the Ten Commandments until the 7th, which is an anomaly and it's a question, and when we get closer to Shavuos we'll talk about it. But this is not a machlokes that's relevant on the holiday of Shavuos. Which means, strangely enough, according to the view that says the Ten Commandments were given on the 7th, we celebrate Shavuos the day before Matan Torah, meaning nothing happened on Shavuos, it was the day before. Okay. Now, one point just to mention, an interpretive point that's actually somebody brought up, that is, we know that before Matan Torah, the Jewish people were told to consecrate and prepare themselves for 3 days, separating from their wives, immersing in a mikveh, whatever the water was. So really, the machlokas of 6 and 7 is how to understand the 3 days of separation. According to one view, the 3 days meant 2 days of separation, and God gave the Torah on the third day. So as a result, the separation would have been Thursday, Friday, and we got the Torah on Shabbat. According to the other view, there were 3 full days of separation. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we got the Torah on Shabbat. Now, since everybody admits that the day of separation was the 4th of Sivan, the Gemara proves that. So it all depends. If the Torah was given on the 6th, you have separation on the 4th and the 5th. Torah is given on the 6th. If it's the 7th, the separation is the 4th, 5th, and 6th. And the Torah is given on the 7th. So ultimately, this machlokas does depend on whether there were 2 days of separation followed by Matan Torah, or there were, in other words, God gave the Torah on the third day, or whether there were three full days of separation. Okay. So those are some chronological notes. But now we go back to the building of the Mishkan, the building of the tabernacle, and we find a very interesting thing, that in Parshas Truma, there's a detailed sequence of the order in which things should be built. And the very first thing that is to be built, constructed, is the Ark, the Aron. And the Torah gives you instructions for the Aron, that it should be wood that is covered with gold on the inside and on the outside. The way Rashi explains it, imagine that you have three boxes. You make a box of wood, right, wood. Then you cover it with gold on the inside, like a box inside, and then cover it with gold on the outside. So that's a very interesting idea, that gold is on the inside and on the outside. The middle is wood. Can you pass me a chumash and a chumash there? It's not as fine. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Now, what are the dimensions of this ark? 2.5 amos long. Now, what is an amma? An amma is supposed to be from the tip of the finger to the elbow, but how it translates into contemporary usage is between 18 inches and 2 feet. It depends on machlokas what an amma is. But it's 2.5 amos long. It is 1.5 amos wide. And it is 1.5 amos high. Now this is actually the wooden box. The gold may have made it a tiny little bit larger in each of its dimensions. So one thing you'll notice about the Aron is that its dimensions are all fractionated, meaning to say they are not in whole numbers. 1.5 by 2.5 by 1.5. These are called midos shavuros, as opposed to the thing that's mentioned later, the shulchan, the golden table, which is also a wooden table that is covered with gold. There, the midos of the shulchan are 2 amos long, that's a whole number, 1 amma wide, a whole number, right, 2, 1, and then an amma and a half high. So an interesting ha'ara that the Kli Yakor discusses is, why are the midos of the Aron all shavuros, and the midos of the Shulchan, some of them are shavuros and some of them are shlemos? Okay, so that's one kasha. Another kasha is like this. When it comes to all of the vessels, the altars, the Shulchan, the verb that is used is viasisa, you shall make, you shall make, you shall make. Now, who is Hashem talking to? Hashem is talking to Moshe. And although Moshe himself did not actually make these things, the person who made them was the artisan Bezalel. That is why, by the way, historically, the very famous art school in Jerusalem that is called the Bezalel Art Academy is named after not some donor Bezalel that gave money, but it is named after the artisan of the Mishkan, Bezalel. But nevertheless, Moshe Rabbeinu is in charge. Bezalel is his shaliach, that's why it says v'yasisa. Because we always have a rule, shalucho shel adam kemosa. A shaliach is like a person. But the one exception is the Aron HaKodesh. The Aron HaKodesh, it does not say, you shall make the ark. But it says, v'asu, they shall make the ark. And this is the only kli where it says that. They, meaning the entire Jewish people, somehow makes the ark. So we have two peculiarities in the construction of the ark that don't appear anywhere else. Number one, v'asu instead of v'asisa. And number two, the midos, the dimensions, are shavuros instead of shlemos. Right? The other parts of the Mishkan are either totally Shalem, or at least it's a mix of fractions and whole numbers. So this is what the Kli Yakar says. The Kli Yakar says a very beautiful thought. What does the Aron HaKodesh represent? In the Aron HaKodesh we keep, what do we keep in the Aron HaKodesh? We keep the Luchos, the tablets that Hashem gave Moshe. Which tablets? Because actually, of course at this point we don't have broken tablets yet. But the Gemara tells us that in the Aron HaKodesh were kept not only the second Luchos that remained whole, but even the broken pieces of the first Luchos were kept in the Aron HaKodesh. Essentially, they were put flat. So you had the broken pieces, and the new Luchos were put on top of the broken Luchos. The Gemara, by the way, gives a beautiful, beautiful meaning for that. It says that if, God forbid, a great Talmud Chacham has forgotten his learning, let's say dementia, Alzheimer's, you still must honor that person, because even the broken Luchos were given a place of honor in the Aron HaKodesh and the Kodesh HaKodashim. And a Talmud Chacham who has forgotten his learning is analogous to the broken Luchos that still have holiness. And Derech Agav, although that's not our topic per se, the reason for that is that the Torah that a person learns transforms their character. So even when you forget the specific information, to some degree, your neshama is different. You have been transformed. Now, obviously, for most of us, maybe the transformation is not as profound as it should be. But for a Talmud Chacham who has toiled so many years, so many hours, so much Mesiras Nefesh, the neshama itself is a different neshama. And therefore, even if the conscious information is not there, the greatness of that soul still exists. In fact, you'll sometimes see this generally with people with Alzheimer's or the like. Sometimes what happens is that their true personality comes out, meaning people who were gentle and kind will in fact be gentle and kind, although they won't know who they're talking to. I had an aunt years ago, my father's sister, who was very, very exceptionally kind and loving person. And at some point, her Alzheimer's was fairly progressed, and for some crazy reason, I'm not sure how it happened, she needed to spend Rosh Hashanah at my place in Silver Spring, Maryland. And she lived in New York, and somehow, you know, why the Alzheimer's person? But anyway, she did not know who I was. She did not know who I was at all. She didn't know. I was her favorite nephew, but she didn't know. And but nevertheless, you know, she offered to clean off the table and, you know, and asking about everybody. So the MS is, the way a person lives their life imprints things on their neshama, even if consciously they're no longer connected to the particular memories. The neshama, the person becomes different. And kal v'chomer, that's true for a Talmud Chacham. And that's why we say the luchais and the shivrei luchais menachas bi'aron. So be it as it may, that's what you would find in the Aron HaKodesh. By the way, something else you would find as well, in the time of the first temple, you would actually find the actual Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote from the beginning of Bereishis to the end of the Torah, because it is recorded in the book of Devarim that on the last day of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, which is an ace, he wrote 12 Sefer Torah. I'm sorry, 13 Sefer Torah in one day? That's pretty amazing. It takes a sofer typically a year to write one Sefer Torah. He wrote 13 in one day. Each Torah was given to the tribes, and the 13th Torah was kept in the Holy of Holies. And that was the master. You know they have something, and I know they probably have it in Israel too. They have in the United States the Bureau of Standards. I think it's still called that. They have the official measurements. You know, what exactly is an inch? They have the official inch, the official yard. Now they use laser because any type of physical ruler would disintegrate with time, right? So everything's official. So the official Torah was in the Kodesh HaKodashim. So if sometimes there had been disagreements, usually minor disagreements, about whether a certain letter should be this way, this is pretty amazing. According to the halacha, they were allowed to go into the Holy of Holies, Kodesh HaKodashim, not on Yom Kippur, in the middle of the year, to check the official Torah and to check it. So be it as it may, there were other things in the Kodesh HaKodashim as well. There was a jar of man as a remembrance of the miracle that God gave the man for the 40 years. And there was the staff of Aaron that produced almonds and flowers. Do you remember that story? This is much later. This is not at this time, but much later in the Torah, after Korach's rebellion. So Hashem made a miracle to show that Aaron was chosen by Hashem to be the Kohen, that all of the Nisim put staffs in the Mishkan, and their staff just remained a stick, and Aaron's stick had flowers and almonds and the like. And that was a divine sign that God had chosen Aaron to be a Kohen. And that staff was kept in the Kodesh HaKodashim. Right? All of that was in the Kodesh HaKodashim. Not in the Ark. Now, again, what was in the Ark itself, everybody says it was the Luchos and the broken Luchos. Where was Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah? That's a machlokas in the Gemara. Was it in the Ark or next to the Ark? It was in the Kodesh HaKodashim, but there's a machlokas where the Torah was. But the other things, the jar of man and the staff, they were not in the Ark. They were next to the Ark, but they were in the Kodesh HaKodashim. Now again, just to give us a little bit of history here. There was no Aron HaKodesh in the Bayis Sheni. And none of the other things were in the Bayis Sheni either. So if you would have, if you were the Kohen Gadol and you would walk into the Kodesh HaKodashim on Yom Kippur, what would you see? You would see nothing at all. It was a totally empty room. It was also an absolutely pitch dark room because there was no natural lighting in the room and there was no windows. It was a windowless chamber. And the only light the Kohen Gadol would have is that, of course, when the Kohen Gadol entered the Kodesh HaKodashim, he entered it with coals, burning coals, on which he placed incense, and that was the only light that was in that room. So it was pretty, I'm sure it was pretty scary anyway, and the light. The only thing that you did see, if you could see anything, you know, through the light of the incense, is that the site of where the Aron HaKodesh was put, it was put on a stone that jutted up from the ground a little bit, only 3 fingers, a little bit of a stone that was jutting up. And that stone goes by the name Even Shisiya, which means foundation stone. And according to our Masorah, according to our oral tradition, that was the place from which God created the world, meaning to say Hashem created that point and he spun the world out from that Even Shisiya. Now, other things are a little conjectural. For example, what is the site that Avraham was ready to sacrifice Yitzchak? What was the site of the dirt that Hashem made Adam HaRishon? Was it that? Or was it the place of the altar? Some say, no, the Akedah was the site of the Mizbeach, not the Kodesh HaKodashim itself. Now, the Even Shisiya, according to the Muslims, that is what they call the Dome of the Rock. They have that rock that they identify as the Even Shisiya. As you know, or you may know, halachically, there is great, great controversy to this day exactly where the Kodesh HaKodashim is. Many, many rabbis and scholars do not identify the Kodesh HaKodashim with the Dome of the Rock. They have other places, and which is really part of the bigger question, why we're not allowed to walk in the Har HaBayis. Theoretically, if we knew where the Kodesh HaKodashim was, we could calculate, and there'd be areas we could walk in. But because of this tremendous uncertainty, that's why most religious Jews do not walk on any part of the Har HaBayis. So the Islamic identification of the Dome of the Rock with the Holy of Holies may be true, but it may not be true, meaning there's a lot of uncertainty. Yeah.
I know in the Muslim religion, there, in Mecca, there was like another stone that they, you know, that they all make a pilgrimage to?
Yeah. That's the Kaaba. Yeah, that's not the Evan Shasiya though. That's something else. I don't remember what it's something to do with Muhammad. But it's not that. They acknowledge the. Of course, I think in their tradition though they also say that. In fact, this is the only chashivas of Jerusalem in Islam. There's only one thing that they claim. And in fact, the Quran, as you know, does not mention Jerusalem once in their entire holy book. But the one thing they claim is that Muhammad ascended to heaven on his horse from that rock and the Dome of the Rock. That's their one Baba Maisa that they have. But overall, Jerusalem is not, again, it's an important point to know, propaganda-wise, that Jerusalem is really, historically, has not been a major, major religious site for Islam. It's only been in recent years, all of a sudden, the Arabs have gotten their new Zionistic connection, Islamic Zionism, to the Temple Mount and to Jerusalem. So now they talk about it as if, you know, this is their holiest place, which it never was. But okay. But be it as it may, therefore, one has to keep in mind that for the whole Bayis Sheni, there was no Aron HaKodesh. And the Kohen Gadol just put the incense on top of the Evan Shasiya. That's all there was. And the like. Now, what happened to the Aron HaKodesh and to the Man and everything else? So it was not captured by the Babylonians. Rather, one of the last righteous kings, Yoshiyahu, before the Churban, knew that Hashem had decreed that the temple would be destroyed. And in order for the Goyim not to get the Aron HaKodesh, the Aron HaKodesh was concealed. He concealed it in subterranean tunnels under the Beis HaMikdash. And we believe it is there to this day. In fact, there are recurring stories over time of people finding it, and you know, and of course if you find it, you can get burnt, you know, looking at the Aron and the like. The story goes that somebody went to the Chafetz Chaim from Eretz Yisrael. A person traveled to Radin and showed him this, and the Chafetz Chaim told him to burn the paper and forget about the instructions and forget about even trying to find the Ark and the like. Now, here's a question that you might ask, that the Torah tells me when you build a Mishkan or you build a temple, you're supposed to have an Ark. Now, things don't have to be the original Ark of Moshe, so the question is, if Moshe's Ark was concealed, I mean, just like we didn't have Moshe's Mizbeach in the second Beis HaMikdash, we built a new one. We didn't have Moshe's menorah in the second Beis HaMikdash, we built a new one. I mean, you have to have these things. It doesn't say they have to be the original. So the question is, why didn't they build an Aron HaKodesh in the Bayis Sheni? Yeah, they didn't have the one that Moshe built. That was put away. But the answer is very simple. The answer is very simple. You can build a new ark, and you can build a new altar, and you can build a new shulchan. All of that is fine. But you can't build a new luchos. That is what comes from God. Now, the mitzvah of having an ark is not a mitzvah to build a box. It's a mitzvah to build a repository for the luchos that God had inscribed. Since we didn't have those luchos, there was no halachic purpose in building an ark. So unlike the Mizbeach and the Shulchan that we did build, even though they were new, we're not going to build an ark if you don't have the luchos. And just to put in your Sefer Torah, that's not it. The Torah didn't say, build the ark to put in your Sefer Torah. The Torah said, build an ark to put in the specific tablets that God engraved. So we don't have that. We can't do it. Okay, but be it as it may, whatever your symbol is, it's fairly clear. I'm going to go back to the Kli Yoker now. That the Aron HaKodesh is a symbol of the Koach of Torah. Torah. Torah is the foundation of our relationship to God. The Torah is the essence of God in ways we don't understand, because God's will and God's essence are one, and the Torah is a concretization of His will. So the Torah represents, or I'm sorry, the Aron HaKodesh represents Torah, and that is why it is the Holy of Holies. Okay. Now, we then have something else. We have the Shulchan. Now the Shulchan was a gold table. Now what was on that gold table? The Lechem HaPanim. That's typically translated as the showbread. Now, what is the Lechem Apanim? Every Friday, 12 challos were baked. Now, here there's something a little misleading, because when I say 12 challos, you undoubtedly think of 12 loaves of bread. However, challos here means bread, indeed, but the Lechem Apanim was not chametz bread. The Lechem Apanim was matzah bread. However, it was not hard. You see, matzah does not have to be like a cracker. In fact, many Sfardim, even today, they make something called soft matzah. Soft matzah looks like a laffa or a pita. You bend it, but it was not allowed to ferment for 18 minutes. Now, the reason why Ashkenazim don't do it is we're scaredy cats, and we're afraid to let the dough rise even a little bit, so we bake it right away, and we bake it to a crisp, to be sure that it's not chametz. Sfardim are bigger risk takers, so to speak, and therefore they're willing to let their dough rise 15 minutes and then bake it. Because as long as you bake it before 18 minutes, it's not chametz. But if you let a dough rise for 15 minutes, you can actually get a soft, spongy dough that's still matzah. And there's all discussion on many Ashkenazim, and I mean not for halachic reasons, but because it tastes better. They're trying to get the OU to certify Sephardic soft matzah and the like, but they don't want to do it because the minhag of Ashkenazim is to have hard, brittle matzah. But I can bring you a proof from the Talmud that indeed the original matzah was soft and spongy, but it didn't rise for 18 minutes, it rose for 15 minutes, whatever it is. Remember the Hillel sandwich, right? You're going to have at the Seder. That Hillel, when he ate the Korban Pesach, used to wrap the Pesach and the matzah and the maror and eat them all together. Instead of eating Pesach and the matzah and maror separately, he wrapped it as a sandwich. Now this is called korech. Now korech means wrapping. I don't mean like rap music, but W-R-A-P, wrapping. It's a wrap. It was a shawarma, absolutely. Pesach is lamb, matzah is the pita, and maror is like the vegetables that you put in. It was a shawarma. So this is way before the Earl of Sandwich. The first sandwich was invented by Hillel. Now, the problem is, the verb that is used is wrap. Now, you can't wrap a piece of hard matzah, right? It breaks. You can't. Matzah doesn't bend. So it's very clear from the very linguistic description that the Lechem HaPanim, not Lechem HaPanim, but the matzah was bendable matzah, and the Lechem HaPanim was also bendable. Right, it was bendable bread, 12 challos, and those challos were baked on Friday. They were put on the golden shulchan in two piles of six. Every Shabbos, it was left on the shulchan 8 days till next Shabbos, and then it would be removed and replaced with the new bread, and was eaten by the Kohanim on Shabbos and Saturday night from Lava Malka. So they had Shabbos and Shabbos night. And there was a miracle that the bread was warm and fresh, even though it was on the Shulchan more than a week. This is called the Lechem HaPanim. And there has to be bread on the Shulchan at all times. So the Chazal even say the way it worked every Shabbos was they would not remove the old bread till they had the new bread. And it would be like inch by inch, meaning to say, when we're taking away the old bread, we move it an inch, and you put the new bread on an inch, right? So I'm moving, and the new bread is being placed on simultaneously with the old bread being removed, because the shulchan can never be bereft of lechem. Lechem hapanim. Now, if you walked into the Mishkan, you're walking, you understand, from east to west, because the Holy of Holies is in the west, far west. Okay? So what are you going to see? To your left, which is the north, right? If you're walking west, the north is to your left. To your left, you will see the Shulchan, the table of the Lechem Apanim. To your right, which is the south, my directions are reversed. If you're going, to the if you're going east to west, so which side is the south? South is to the left. Yeah, south is to the left, yeah. So to your left is the menorah. To your right is the table of the Lechem Apanim. And then in the middle, there's a golden altar, which you bring incense. The altar of the Karbanis is in the courtyard, but in the building of the Mishkan itself, you have the Shulchan, I'm sorry, you have the menorah to your left, you have the Shulchan to your right, you have the golden altar in the middle, and if you keep on walking, you'll get the curtain with the Kodesh HaKadoshim and the Aron HaKodesh, right? That's what's in the Mishkan. Now, the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says, the Shulchan represents the conduit for Parnassa. God gives you sustenance, bread. He gives you the ability to make a living. The menorah represents the light of Torah. So we really have two symbols for Torah. We have the Aron HaKodesh, which is Torah, and we have the menorah, the light of the menorah, which is divine light of Torah. I'll discuss later why we have two symbols. So Shulchan is the conduit for Parnassa. The light of the menorah and the Aron are the conduit for Torah. The Shulchan is on the north side of the Mishkan. The menorah is on the south side of the Mishkan. So the Gemara in Bava Basra says, we see from here that if you want to daven to God for wisdom, you should face the south, because the menorah is the south. If you want to daven to God for Parnassa, wealth, you should face the north, because the Shulchan is to the north. Now, this halachically raises an obvious question. What do you mean, face north or south? The halacha is, you're supposed to face Yerushalayim. And when you're in Yerushalayim, you're supposed to face the Temple Mount. And when you're next to the Temple Mount, you face the Holy of Holies. There's no north, south, east, west. Wherever you are, you have to turn to the direction of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So the Gemara explains that certainly your dominant direction always has to be towards the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So let's say in America, that's why the Aron HaKodesh is east, because we're turning east. But you incline a little bit, meaning if you want Parnassa, you do a slight northeast. If you want wisdom, you do a slight southeast. Okay? I used to have a joke that in my old shul, which was built way before I got there, because of the condition of the ground, the Aron HaKodesh could not be built east. So it was built due north. So that's kind of materialistic, pure materialism. You're just praying for money and Ashiras. But okay. But given this idea that the south, we don't know why, but the south represents the direction of knowledge and insight, Chachma Satorah. And the north represents the direction of Parnassa and sustenance. And that's why the Shulchan is on the north and the menorah is on the south, right? So now the Kli Yakar says the following idea. Going back to the fact that the ark, all of its dimensions are fractions, not whole numbers, when it comes to Torah knowledge, we should always feel incomplete and inadequate. We are never whole. We never feel, I know enough, I learned enough. Even if one is a great, great Talmud Chacham, right? Or Rav Yashiv, been learning for 98 years. What is he still learning over and over and over and over again? In fact, that is why a great, great scholar of Torah is called a Talmid Chacham. Talmid actually means a student of the wise, because a truly learned person is still a student. When you think you're wise, that's a sign that you're not. Right? The perpetual student. You know, they tell the story about Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who was a great, great rabbi who came from Europe in the 1920s. At a time when there were no yeshivas, I mean, there was no real strong Orthodox life in America at all. But he eventually settled in Cincinnati. He was quite a colorful figure, very recalled. In fact, he was actually politically well-connected eventually as well. After the Holocaust, he saved many, many Jews from monasteries and convents, Jewish children. And he was very friendly with Robert Taft, who was the, if you know your American history, He was the minority leader of the United States Senate, a very, very powerful politician, the son of President William Howard Taft. And Rabbi Silver, who could barely speak English, used all of his connections to rescue Jews. He was very colorful at one point, but be it as it may, legend has it, I don't want to say for sure, I don't know if the story is true, that he lost his first job in America. He was hired by a synagogue, and the president fired him because the president accused him of wasting electricity at night. And when Rabbi Silver said, well, I'm sitting in the shul and I'm learning. So the president said, I knew it. I thought we had a rabbi who finished his education. He says, we're not going to pay for your schooling. You know, you misrepresented. You said that you finished. Now, anyone that learns in yeshiva knows what a crazy remark that is, as if to say, oh, you finished learning and you're graduated. So the reason why all of the midos of the Aron are fractions is that one should always have the attitude, I've just begun. I really don't know. And of course, one of the perhaps frustrating experiences you will have is you will encounter that the more you know, the more you realize how little you know. It's as if every time you feel you reached a certain place, all of a sudden a whole bunch of new tunnels open up that haven't yet been explored. And that's going to happen, God willing, to happen the rest of your lives. That there's never going to be a point at which you've arrived, because the Torah is infinite in its wisdom. Now, when it comes to the Shulchan, though, the Shulchan represents the physical world, the material world, the Gashmiyistika world. So here, at least some of the dimensions are complete. Because when it comes to Gashmiyis, you should be happy with what you have. There shouldn't be the incessant demands, I need to get more. I should feel content, I should be happy, I should be satiated. If my life is simple and not elaborate or fancy, Baruch Hashem, that's going to be good. I have less on my mind. So that's why some of the dimensions are whole. But then you'll ask the Kasha, so why are some fractions? I mean, this would make sense if everything would be whole in the sense that I have everything I need. The answer is, this is another Musar for a person. That Hashem gives you everything you need, but then you try to control your self-indulgence. But don't take everything that you want. Meaning, Hashem gives me X amount, but I don't indulge to the fullest extent, but I separate myself from that which is unnecessary. So that's kind of the attitude of Ruchnius versus Gashmius. With Ruchnius, there's an incessant search for more. With Gashmius, there is a point at which you say, Baruch Hashem, I accept my life. And the Kli Yakar says that this can explain a Gemara very beautifully. The Gemara says the following. When a person davens, his eyes should be looking downward and his heart should be soaring upward. This is a Gemara in Brachos, meaning the stance of a person davening is you look down as if you're in submission before God, but your heart is reaching up to connect to Hashem. That's a Gemara, right? Einav lamata and libo lamala. And the simple meaning is the true meaning, but the Kli Yakar gives an allegorical meaning as well. He says, Einayim refers to I look around and I see all the things that people have. They have this car and that house and the like. So when it comes to your eyes, your physical environment, look at the guys who are worse than you and say, Baruch Hashem, Hashem gave me this and I'm not suffering like someone below me. Meaning, don't look at the people who have more than you and be jealous. Look at the people below you and be grateful. But when it comes to your heart, that means the heart to understand Torah, there you look at the people, lamala, look at the people above you and say, not be jealous, but I mean, I want to aspire to be like them. That's a beautiful pshat. So in Torah, look at the people better, because otherwise you could have a big yetzirah. You know, I hate to tell you this, maybe I shouldn't tell you this, it'll give you a swelled head. But you know, right now, you guys know more Torah than 75% of the Jews in the world. You're the top 25% right now. That's pretty amazing. Pretty scary. And the thing is, a person might say, you know, 75% of the Jews are more ignorant than me. So I'm in a pretty good place. Can't do that. You can't look at the people below you. You have to look at the people above you. Am I Rav Yashiv yet? Probably not. You know, so that's a different thing. So when it comes to Torah, don't focus on all the people who, unfortunately, for no fault of their own, and God forbid, I'm not being critical, no fault of their own. People didn't have the opportunity, they didn't have the gifts, they just didn't have the opportunity. And Baruch Hashem, Hashem enabled you to find this opportunity. But you can't look at all the people that you left behind. You have to look at the great tzaddikim that you try to emulate. But when it comes to Gashmias, yeah, Baruch Hashem, you're also living better than, I don't know what percentage, but better than a very, very large group of people in the world. You have a home, you have a roof, you have food to eat, etc. So when it comes to Gashmias, look at the people below and be grateful. When it comes to Torah, look at the people above and aspire. Yeah.
So for the part of dying for Kedusha, some people do look up, right?
You look up momentarily. In other words, the basic concept is, in fact, even during Shemoneh Esrei itself, it is brought down that a person should sporadically raise their eyes to heaven just to remind themselves of the connection to God. Because even when you're begging a king, you'll sometimes, look up. Mm-hmm. But it's like sporadically looking up, but the dominant pose should be one of submission. Right? That's the combination of that. Okay, you all have a good day. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.